Well, are we getting to that point where people can kind of relax and catch a breath? Well, maybe not if you're still chopping corn or digging spuds. Those guys are still going like crazy out in the field in Whatcom County. And all over the state, too. You know, I was trying to connect with some farmers over in eastern Washington, and I'm like, nope, too busy. You know, whether it's fruit harvest, they're still harvesting tree fruit over there, and then chopping silage over there, and, you know, winter wheat's getting planted, and all this kind of stuff going on. Here in Whatcom County, though, the berry farmers are finally to the point where they can kick back a little bit, even though there's always the fall time stuff to do. Welcome back to the Farming Show. Dylan Honkoop here on KGMI with you on your Saturday morning. Glad you're here. And it's time we can finally talk to some of these guys, because we've been trying to get them on the phone for weeks. Has it been months now, after kind of a wild roller coaster of a berry season? Raspberries and blueberries in particular is what we're going to be talking. We finally got a hold of one person. Todd van Mersbergen. With us, a red raspberry and blueberry grower up in North Whatcom County, a guy I've known since, well, I guess I was four, if I recall, I was 4 years old when we met, Todd.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah, you were five.
Yeah, thanks for that intro too, Dylan. Just, you know, we're just kicking back, you know, yep. Got a cold drink in our hand.
Yeah, that's all you're doing.
Yeah.
So, no, but at least you answer the phone. At least you're answering the phone now, you know, because, you know, middle of July, you know, forget that. There would have been no conversation like this happening. So a conversation for a farm, you know, for a farmer, you know, this is kicking back here, you know, that you have 15 minutes to chat with me.
Very true.
How did it go this season? Coming into raspberry season, things were looking pretty good, if I recall. And the market was sounding relatively healthy, like the price was maybe going to be okay this year. And then as we got into June, we saw this bizarre forecast about this heat dome, right? Talk about what was going on at that point.
Yeah, you know, it was a pretty good spring, both raspberries and blueberries. And, you know, we were going into June, had some pretty good pollination weather. You know, the bees were out working. And
you can have great weather during harvest. But if it's rainy and terrible the whole time, you know, the 6 weeks prior while the blooms are out and they're needing to be pollinated, you can still have just a mediocre crop.
Yeah. So, you know, the spring was favorable. We got to that mid-June point, and, you know, there was started to be a little buzz going around in the forecast. And yeah, we got to the mid to late 20s of June.
Yep.
And that heat dome really, really zapped us, more on the raspberry side than the blueberry side.
But. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a real roller coaster, you know, starting with the spring and then the heat dome and then getting into harvest. You know, it was definitely an interesting year, like no other.
Were you harvesting anything when that heat hit? That was still like about a week before most people started picking, right?
So we've got an earlier variety that was, if the heat dome hadn't hit, we would have started picking it already. About that time frame, the last week of June, but we held off. We didn't want to put our folks in the field on the machines in that sort of weather. So we just waited until after the worst of it. I think it was on Tuesday morning we picked from, like, you know, we did like kind of what they do in eastern Washington. We started at 4 or 5 in the morning and got out by noon. I think that day it was only, you know, the high was only 95 instead of 105, yeah, 107 the day before. So
yeah, I remember that being the Friday. It was like 90 something. Saturday was a solid 100. It was 105 plus at my place, which is, by the way, for those listening.
Yeah, I think I can see your place from here.
Yeah, it's just up the road from Todd's field. So I've been watching everything that's been going on, and then the next day was like 108 on that Monday.
Yep.
So Tuesday back down to 95 felt somewhat cool. I mean, anytime I know, and for folks that don't know, this is Dylan Honka, by the way, on KGMI here on the Farming Show, talking with Todd van Mersbergen. And he was my neighbor, grew up down the road from me, still farms down the road from me. My dad farms the other way up the road. So we're all from the same neighborhood. My dad's a red raspberry grower. And anytime over the years, when it gets up over 80, he's starting to get cranky. He's like, this isn't good for my berries.
Right.
95 is way too hot. 108, what did it actually do to him?
So on our, like I said, we've got an earlier variety, and that had a lot of ripe fruit on it. You know, it was ready to go, ready to be harvested. And what it did is, you know, any berry that was red and exposed to the sun, so, you know, on the outside of the bushes, just turned white. I don't know if you know what a raspberry looks like. Obviously, I hope everybody knows what a raspberry looks like, but it's got a lot of those little cells, you know, that make up the berry.
Druplets.
And druplets, exactly. So I didn't know how scientific you wanted to get, but yeah, so those just fried white and shriveled up. Luckily, on that variety, it was a younger field, so the plants recovered. After three or four pickings, we got a lot of that shriveled up, white, sunburned fruit off, and then we got into some pretty good fruit for the rest of the year.
What did you do with all that white fruit? Was it still good for, like,
I mean, it's good for it's good for puree and juice, you know, the lower grade stuff. The taste is still there. It's just not appropriate, you know, for IQF or anything like that.
IQF, of course, being individual quick frozen, the kind of stuff you buy in the bag at Costco or wherever. Well, you get a bag of fruit at Costco, you don't want hard frozen white berries
that
have been sunburned.
No. So luckily, you know, we still have some markets for that. We got into some good fruit on the raspberries after that, or later varieties that weren't quite so ripe at that point in late June. They were not quite as affected fruit quality wise. And once we got that sunburned fruit off, the quality of the rest of the season was on raspberries was actually pretty good. It was just, you know, the plants got really stressed by that heat. And I'd say, you know, just to kind of bring it down to brass tacks, we were probably down, you know, 40% production from where we thought, you know, going into the season we would be. So, so on the raspberry side, that was disappointing for sure. But, you know, every year is different and you kind of take the challenges as they come. And luckily, like you mentioned earlier, the market is strong for raspberries. So the price was pretty good. So, you know, we're able to make it to next year and hope for the next year, you know.
And that was the kicker with this whole situation, because just as a little bit of backstory, and we've talked about this on the program, but for folks that don't recall, the red raspberry market has really been struggling for the past few years, in particular. And, you know, there had been talk, and we talked about it here on the show, about, you know, dumping, illegal trade practices potentially depressing the price, and oversupply and different things going on in the market. That had been coupled with some bad harvests in recent years, some bad weather. So going into this summer, it was like, okay, this might be the one that kind of saves some people. And then with all this loss to the heat, it was like, oh man. And you know, you're talking about potentially 40% loss. You know, I'm hearing it runs the gamut from, you know, the farther southwest you go, you know, folks out more, you know, west of Linden, out towards Ferndale, they were maybe seeing 10 or 20% because it didn't get as hot out there. People more close to Sumas were, you know, talking like 50, 60, 70% loss. That's awful. And it's like, when we saw this heat dome coming, we thought, oh great, here we go, you know, finally it was going to be a good situation. And no, we get kicked in the butt again. But did that, what's the talk behind the scenes? Did that loss of production due to the heat, etc., cause an even further strengthening of the price in the market?
Right. So, you know, that's economics, right? Supply and demand, economics 101. So like you kind of mentioned with your talk of dumping and trade issues, you know, we are in a global market and there's a few other growing regions, you know, Eastern Europe, Chile, that are not having quite as good a luck either with raspberries. So there is a supply shortage in red raspberries. So coupled with, you know, Whatcom County being down, there is the hope that going forward, you know, with the lower supply could lead to some strengthening in pricing for the next, you know, 2 to 3 years. So, you know, that's farming though. You know, you always, you're hoping for the best. And then if it doesn't turn out, you just want to make it to next year and you hope for the best next year. You know, you got to be an optimist to be in this business. So, you know, that's kind of the posture we take. So
I'll ask you this, because I've had people ask me and I thought the same thing too. I've gotten varying answers from folks, so I'm curious what your answer. Again, we're talking with Todd Van Mersbergen, local Whatcom County red raspberry and blueberry grower. We'll get to the blueberries in just a minute. But with the heat dome and the damage and then the loss of yield on red raspberries, then the price also strengthening, did it make up the difference? The higher, you know, you may produce 40% right. less, but if you get enough money for that, you know, reduced crop, then maybe you still, your bottom line is still okay.
Right.
I've gotten mixed answers from people on that.
Yeah. So like on a cash flow year to year comparison, you know, we can't quite make that determination yet, but comparing, you know, season 2020 to the season for 2021, you know, on our operation, we're not on our raspberry side. We're not going to be quite where it was on 2020, but definitely not as devastating as it could have been with a 40 to 50% loss. So, so it's obviously not very exciting to pick a crop with a bunch of sunburned fruit, mm-hmm. shriveled fruit, and you know your yields are going to be down. You know, you keep waiting for that big pick to hit, but you just don't see it on the bushes. That gets a little depressing. But when the price strengthens, then that can, you know, now that we're a couple, two, 3 months removed from it, you start to see, you calm down a little bit, yep. and you kind of get in the
Excel spreadsheets, you kick back.
You're looking at numbers. Yeah, you kick back with your Mai Tai and take a look at the numbers. It actually, you know, it's not going to be too far off from where we were, the last 3 year average or so.
Even though the last few years have been okay, but not great, especially depending on the segment of the market that you were in. Last year, a couple years before that, especially if you were in the lower grade markets, whether it's juice or a B grade product, you were really hurting. Does it make up the difference? Maybe not all of it, but some of it. And we want these local berry farmers to be doing as well as they possibly can. That's good for everybody here in the community, whether you're in berry farming or not. There's my soapbox comment for
thanks,
a second.
Dylan.
Again, talking with Todd Van Mersbergen, red raspberry and blueberry grower here on The Farming Show. I'm Dylan Honkoop here on KGMI. And we got to talk about the blueberries because, you know, we've been talking about this heat dome, all that
right.
heat, the heat storm, as me and Rufus Lalone called it at the time. At the time I was thinking, well, you know, the blueberries will be, you know, they have a little thicker skin to them. You know, they're a little, you know, they're later than red raspberries. They start more like mid July. A lot of that fruit will be green. They'll be okay. They're likely to fare better than raspberries, but that wasn't necessarily the case.
Right. So we've got a few different varieties of blueberries as well. Our earliest variety is Duke, which is primarily a lot of the acreage in Whatcom County is going to be Duke.
Yeah.
Like you said, usually ripens mid to late July. And we were looking, it was looking good. Like I said, we had some pretty good pollination weather. We had good success with pollination. That's kind of like the biggest thing to worry about in the spring. The fruit set was pretty good. The sizing was good. With blueberries, it was really interesting. You could see it that when the heat dome hit, the berries, that's usually late June is when they're really starting to turn blue and they're really sucking up the moisture and sizing. Yep. That's a big consideration. And they just kind of stopped sizing. And cause you can see it, you know, and you're like, we were thinking, oh man, you know, we're just going to have a bunch of small fruit and it's not going to weigh very much because the plant shut down. Cause we still had, you know, probably 2 or 3 weeks to go before we were going to be harvesting. Mm-hmm. On our farm, the plants did, start to take up moisture again. They kicked back into gear. So we were able to get the fruit to size up, not quite as good as we normally can.
Yeah.
So our blueberries, you know, we thought it was going to be, X pounds, and we probably got pretty close to that. It wasn't as far off as maybe some guys. The thing about blueberries this year is it was variable, like extremely variable from field to field.
Why do you think that was? Because I know, like we talked about, further southwest right. or further northeast, the further northeast you went, the hotter it got when it was at the hottest. But it's still spotty kind of beyond that variation?
Yeah, so obviously the biggest variation would be a geographical distribution of the heat. You mentioned, you know, the closer to the water to Birch Bay, Puget Sound were.
Yep.
The cooler it stayed and, the less damage you would see in your fields. I got a field that's, you know, closer to Custer and Blaine, and we'd had minimal damage out there that you could see. And then our fields, you know, closer, you know, by Everson, Sumas, there was some more damage. And then as you got, you know, into Sumas area, the far east point of the county, that's where you really saw a lot of damage in the blueberries. The other variable too was variety. Mm-hmm. You know, with raspberries, there's maybe three or four main varieties that are grown. With blueberries, there's quite a few.
Yeah.
You know, timing of harvest, timing of ripening, you know, you got, you know, like I said, the Dukes that start first, you know, you go into your Eurekas, Blue Crops, Liberties, Calypso is a new one. I mean, there's probably 10 to 12 varieties mm-hmm. grown locally. And that did have a little bit, different varieties got hit harder with the heat than.
Was it kind of random, or was it the earlier the
to
variety?
To me, it was random, but nah, it wasn't the early variety. Some of the later varieties were the ones that got hit the hardest. You know, I heard Calypso sustained some damage, which is a later variety. Also Aurora, which is another late variety. You know, picking in September, early to mid-September. So I don't know if it was maybe plant material. You know, blueberries are grown pretty much everywhere in North America, you know, Latin America, all across the world, really. So the genetics are a lot more, you know, not quite as suited just to the Northwest. Right. You know, so you maybe have a variety that isn't quite suited to our climate that you plant because of certain other characteristics,
right?
You know, so that could have had an impact on that as well.
So all in all, you guys did okay. I know some others, again, we're talking about how this was random. Some people really lost their shorts this year.
Right.
And I, you know, going out to look at some of those fields, and I know I took some pictures, you know, even CBS News got in touch with me at one point, wanted to, you know, some images from the blueberry crop damage that happened out here when it got picked up by the media, and just going out to take those pictures and video for them. It was just, it right. looked bad in some spots. How you're with the Washington State Blueberry Commission as well.
Yes.
How did it come together for everybody? All in all, is there a sense yet of kind of where production ended up?
Yeah. So I guess just regionally, I guess I shouldn't, you know, I kind of told my story a little bit, but to put it in the perspective of more of the region, which I would include Oregon and British Columbia as well.
Yeah.
In the Pacific Northwest blueberry region, you know, there's a lot of production in Eastern Washington. They obviously were a lot hotter than us even and stayed, they had a lot of days, you know, we cooled down into the 80s, but they'd be over 100 over there for a lot of July. And then you got up into BC, and when we were experiencing the heat dome, you know, they were as well. And, you know, we talk about Sumas, you know, east part of Whatcom County, but a lot of their blueberries go up even farther into the Fraser Valley, you know, Chilliwack, up into that area. And they sustained a lot more damage than we did here in Whatcom. Oregon as well, you know, their main area is the Willamette Valley, which is, you know, south of Portland, Salem area, where it gets, you know, as a trend, it's warmer there than it is here.
Yep.
So they got, you know, into the 115, 117 during the heat dome. So, you know, Whatcom County probably fared in the Pacific Northwest region, you know, Whatcom, Skagit County probably got the least of the damage out of everything as a region. You know, I heard stories of, you know, 50, 60% crop loss up in BC and down in the Willamette Valley. Down in Oregon. So as a region, you know, we're going to be down 20-25%, I would say. You know, the numbers are still coming in on production, but
and people didn't that long ago finish picking with some of the latest varieties,
exactly.
Right? It's I mean, those will go almost up to October.
Yes, yes. The harvest is still, you know, just wrapping up on blueberries on the late stuff. And so those numbers, you know, we'll have a better feel for those, you know, coming in January. When a lot of that production reports come in, but definitely our area was down this year on blueberry production too, not just raspberries. So the heat definitely had an effect on that too.
Todd Van Mersbergen with us, local blueberry and red raspberry grower here on the Farming Show. Just 30 seconds left, Todd. Where's the blueberry market been at? That's something I know less about than raspberries. I've heard that the price has softened, but I don't know what the effect of this down summer is going to be. What are people talking about?
Right. So the blueberry market's a little bit different than the raspberry market. You know, it's very much, there's a big U.S. Domestic production, a lot of production in other parts of the country, as well as, you know, Latin America, South America, up in Canada as well, obviously with BC, just north of us. But, you know, so it's definitely a different market. There's, you know, production is growing around the world, but the demand is growing too. You know, blueberries have become a staple, and we're just kind of riding that, that wave of demand with the wave of supply. And, prices aren't as high as maybe they used to be, but they're still profitable.
Okay.
And,
that's good.
That's
good, because again, we want these growers around here, including yourself, to be making money, because when that doesn't happen, farming doesn't happen, and we lose farmland, and we, you know, lose so many support businesses. It's all tied together here in the Whatcom County in the Pacific Northwest farming economy. Again, local raspberry and blueberry grower Todd Van Mersbergen with us here on the Farming Show this morning. Todd, thanks for taking the time and all the good info.
Yep, no problem. Thanks, Dylan.
Well, you know, it's getting bad when the government that's supposed to follow the science says they're doing so, but when you look for the science, it doesn't even exist. No, I'm not talking about COVID stuff or any of that drama. I'm talking about farming and regulation for farming, particularly dairy farming in Washington State. It's gotten so bad here in Washington State that now courts are citing non-existent studies to support their rulings. You think I'm making this up? I'm not. Welcome back to the Farming Show. Dylan Honkoop here on KGMI News Talk 790. Glad to have you here on a Saturday morning to talk about farming issues here in Whatcom County, Skagit County, and across Washington State, as we do each and every Saturday morning. Literally, the study, the science, and I'm heavily using the air quotes on that, the study, the science to support a ruling of a Washington appeals court did not exist. They're using numbers that, as we find out, were estimates that didn't apply, and there was no study to support what they said they were doing. What are we talking about? We're talking about the rules for dairy farming, for manure, for compost, for things like protecting groundwater. It's an important thing to do. But we know there's been a lot of drama and politics around this issue, certainly here in Whatcom County and statewide as well, with their rules over CAFOs. I think the jury's still out on it. Our guest, Jay Gordon with the Dairy Federation. Have we settled? Is it a CAFO or a CAFO?
Flip a coin.
Flip a coin. A concentrated animal feeding operation falls under a specific set of rules according to Washington state government. Of course, we know the activists were heavily involved the last time the state went through this whole process, trying to basically choke out dairy farming in Washington state with all kinds of machinations that were, well, dishonest in a lot of cases, unethical, and, you know, the state pollution control hearings board rejected a lot of the things that those folks were trying to manipulate, but there's still manipulation going on, and we may have uncovered another example of that here. Jay, explain, how can our court system here in Washington state be making rules, essentially, or, you know, pushing rules in a certain direction based on a study that doesn't exist? What's this all about?
I don't even know where to begin. I guess courts get to rely on whatever they want to. So let me know where you want me to start.
Well, we're talking about these CAFO rules, and they're claiming, and the court is claiming, that dairy operations and the manure, the nutrients, and the compost that they store on site to then reapply, you know, that's how they grow the crops to feed the animals. The animals kick out the manure, and the cycle continues. We talk about this a lot here on the program, so I think we should be familiar with this. Well, they're saying, well, these facilities leach huge amounts of nitrogen into groundwater. And the number was just astounding, but it turned out that it was fake.
Yeah, so the number the court cited, it was based on a study out of Yakima. The 155 tons of nitrogen leached into the groundwater per compost operation.
And especially on the east side, there's a lot of manure that's composted, right?
There is, but the number was, it just didn't pass straight face test. It was wrong. It was unbelievable. It was impossible. And as we kind of dug into it, and we're still digging into this, it's just, we're flabbergasted. And the court basically looked and said, oh, yeah, there's a problem here because you're leaching all this nitrogen in the groundwater, except it's not getting into the groundwater. That's not what the study said. That's not what anything said. But the court reached in and grabbed an obscure email, and we're waiting to see if we can get that email. The court basically issued an opinion based on a obscure email that...
I want to talk a bit more about the process here, how this is even possible. But before we get to that, and again, we're talking with Jay Gordon with the Washington State Dairy Federation. He's their policy director. Jay, what is ultimately the upshot for farmers, for dairy farming here in Washington State, because of the court absolutely misusing this data that didn't even apply?
So I think there's two. It puts the farmers in a bad position, and the Department of Ecology, believe it or not, it puts the Department of Ecology in a terrible position. The court issued an opinion based on, I'll just call it a falsehood. We're trying to confirm that, but there's no way it's real numbers. And so the court said, you have to figure out how to have compost operations not leach nitrogen into the groundwater. But their decision and their opinion was based on a myth, a smoke mirrors.
And basically they believed that there was this huge problem when there isn't.
Exactly.
So is this going to require a whole bunch of more ridiculous regulations and improvements and things that farmers are going to have to do in the areas where they're composting manure or groundwater monitoring, if I recall, is kind of the initial big issue here that's being argued over.
Well, there's groundwater monitoring, but you know, when you are trying to compost an operation or trying to compost on a dairy, you know, let's use the right numbers, the right science. And the court clearly did not. And so Department of Ecology, to their credit, has said the court has their opinion. We, as the Department of Ecology, have to use real science. So over the next almost year, the Department of Ecology will have to tease out what the actual real numbers are. But they're stuck between this court ruling and what they, you know, what they need to do. And it's quite a dilemma.
What do farmers do in the meantime? Because they don't even know. I mean, they have rules that the court says they have to abide by, but now they know that those rules are based on absolute, you know, faulty data and information. What happens now for them?
Not a good answer for you, Dylan. I you know, at some point you hope the court and the judges will look at honesty and data and say, "Oops," but this court clearly did not. It did not. It looked at some little obscure piece of evidence in the trial and said, "We're going to issue a ruling on that."
Now,
at this point, I would not advise any producer to change anything about how they compost on their dairy farms because the court just. They got it wrong. Sorry. They just got it wrong.
How is this even possible? How can you have made up numbers or numbers? You know, I guess you could say the number isn't made up. The number is something else. You know, you can't say, oh, well, we have, you know, 100 apples over here. And someone says, oh, okay, well, because you have 100 peaches. Well, no, we said apples. They're different things. You can't just apply a number to something else. How can that even happen in a system like ours? I think people tend to have more faith in the system that this kind of garbage doesn't fall through the cracks like this did.
You know, this is a first for me. You want to hope the judges look at, you know, good information that's been cross-examined and scrutinized and, you know, has a modicum of science integrity. And instead, this court seemed to just grab some obscure quote from a corner of the submitted testimony and made a decision on it. And I will give the Department of Ecology credit. In the last day or two, we've asked Ecology, how are you going to comply with this court ruling? And they said, we need to use good, credible science and data, not made up stuff. And so bless their heart, you know, at least right now, I'm going to hold them to it, that the Department of Ecology is going to listen to credible data, credible information. Apparently a court and judges don't need to do that. And like I said, this is a first for me.
I think folks who listen to this program know that I'm pretty darn skeptical, if not cynical, about our quote unquote system. And our state administration in particular and agencies and bureaucracies, and I just don't see them working very well. I see them being manipulated behind the scenes by people with, you know, strong interests and lots of money and things that they're trying to accomplish. This just absolutely, you know, takes my skepticism to a new low. or high, however you want to measure it. How can you trust a government that does this kind of stuff? Ah, it's sickening to me.
You know, I mean, the good part, I guess, you know, to counter your jaded cynicism, the courts seem to have hit a new low, but at least from what I'm talking to the staff of the Department of Ecology, they're going, We cannot follow the court down a pathway that does not use good, best available science. And the court did not. It picked out a back of the napkin calculation. Like I said, we're waiting to see if we can find more, you know, a little more tangible proof of what the court found.
Yeah. But yeah. I want to know, who did they get this from? What was going on behind the scenes of why they decided to pick out this number that basically created a problem or a perception of a problem where there was none by pulling a cherry-picked, unapplicable number and then making punitive rules? I mean, we're so far beyond even just legislating from the bench in a lot of ways here. We're legislating from the bench based on BS. And again, by the way, this is The Farming Show. Dylan Honkoop here talking with Jay Gordon with the Washington State Dairy Federation about this, you know, court ruling on dairy regulations based on a non-existent study. The science isn't there. Again, as you said, Jay, this is a new low. You sit back and you got to wonder, how did this all go down, and what's the game really behind the scenes? There's where my cynicism really starts. Is there a bigger game here? It harkens back to what happened with the EPA and their nitrate study. That happened in the lower Yakima Valley, where we find out later the methods that they use were designed to paint a false picture of what was going on with nitrates and dairy farming there. To me, this is right in the same vein.
EPA and the court. I mean, one's a, yeah, I wish I could tell you you were wrong.
Well, and in this case, in some ways, I mean, this is something that I've been saying for a long time in my work here at Safe Family Farming, is that, you know, people view the courts as being, you know, supposed to be an unbiased, neutral, you know, focused on the law, arbiter of issues. And our state agencies, while we want them to be working for the people, I recognize that they can be a party in a court case. They're a part of that. They can be advocating for their position. There can be others advocating for different positions. This is the opposite of that. This is the court actually taking a position that's not even supported by the state agency.
No. Yeah. They skipped right through the court skipped through all of the procedures, public hearing, public testimony. Is this credible data? Is this science? What are the ramifications? What are the impacts? What are the costs and effects on farms, dairies, and, you know, other farms that compost? The court skipped all of those safety protocols we have in society to go, you know, what does this mean? What is the impact? You know, is anybody really impacting public resources like groundwater quality or surface water quality? How much does it cost to rectify? The court skipped all of it. It leaves you, I mean, you and I are both this sort of muttering. It leaves you muttering, going, what the heck?
Mm-hmm. Well, as you said, you're still digging on this because I think this is so egregious, it deserves more answers. It's not just like an, oh, oops, oh, yeah, I guess we got that number wrong. This took some coordination behind the scenes. This took someone potentially with an axe to grind to dig up stuff and put it in a place that created, again, the perception of a problem where there was none. It's hurting not only dairy farming, but if you think about composting, and if you're making that much more, you know, that much harder, that more much more expensive here in Washington State, well, that, you know, that supports a huge portion of the organic agriculture, you know, fruits and veggies and things like that grown in this state. They've got to have that. This is an important part of the nutrient cycle. You know, when you want to talk about climate change and carbon, this is what it's all about. Compost, nutrients, natural ways of feeding crops and feeding people. And yet they're putting a damper on this with made up stuff. It's backwards from where we need to be going as a society. And it certainly is disgusting as far as rule of law and procedures and having an open and transparent and honest government that is actually focused on science. I my gut tells me there's more here. I think that story needs to be told. Jay, I know you're going to keep digging, and when you find out more, I want to have you back on the show because I want to hear who was it that did this and what did they know and what can we even find out or potentially surmise about what was their motivation to do this. This kind of stuff can't stand and needs to be exposed. This is a sunshine thing for me. This is you know, what's going on in the dark corners of government. Let's shine some light on it.
And I'll be glad to make sure I'll let you know, and you and I can arrange another time. I don't know how long it'll take me. We have reached out to the Department of Ag, Department of Ecology, and we'll be digging. Well, we're not done digging. How about that?
All right. Well, someone could say, well, this is procedural, or maybe it was just an oops. No, there's more here when something this crazy is going on inside our state government, and it has real-world impacts on farming and our entire communities, ultimately, with this kind of stuff. Jay Gordon, Policy Director at the Washington State Dairy Federation, with me here on the Farming Show this morning. Jay, thanks for your time. We appreciate you not only, you know, chatting with us this morning, but all the work you do behind the scenes to keep tabs on this stuff, dig this kind of stuff up, get to the bottom, and force people to be honest and fair.
Hey, more than welcome. It's part of my job, and I'm a farmer, and so, yeah, appreciate it. Appreciate the time, and we will let you know when we find out more.